Information abounds about H1N1 flu prevention, infection control, and best hygiene practices. Is this message resonating with groups that, according to public health officials and major health organizations like the World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control, and the Health Protection Agency of Canada, are at most risk of harm should they become infected with H1N1? One group is a focus of study for two Carleton University researchers who note that these messages are not resonating with many students. What is the reason for this reaction, and is there a better way to communicate health risks concerns to this specific population? I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Jaime Anisman, Canada Research Chair in Neuroscience and Professor in the Institute of Neurosciences at Carleton University, and Professor at the Institute of Mental Health Research at the Royal Ottawa Hospital. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing just fine, and a little frustrated because lots of information out there to try to convey to people to have them understand within reason and certainly without hyperbole risks associated with, in this case, H1N1. And my first question, though, is how do people determine health risks? That is, what modes of thinking and evaluation do they use? And does this vary with specific age groups and cultures?
This is a good question. This is what we're trying to assess in several ways. But I have to go backwards a bit first.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
When we encounter stressors, any type of stressor, there's a process that we typically go through. And think of a stressor as a threat. I first would make, for example, a preliminary appraisal and ask the question at some level, is this a threat to me? And then I might make a second appraisal where I say, do I have the coping resources to deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a threat, say, of potential business loss, well, I can come up with some coping strategy. I can use a problem-solving method or social support seeking, get a friend to help me out, something of this nature. But there are certain types of threats that are more difficult to cope with, not because they're necessarily more lethal, for example, but because they're ambiguous. And H1N1 is one of these. We don't know whether let's go back in time. We didn't know whether this would actually be a mm-hmm. pandemic. Then once it was announced that it probably would be, how severe would it be? Would there be a mutation so that the virus would become either more lethal or more infectious? And now we have a whole bunch of other ambiguous events going on. Is there enough vaccine to go around? Are there any problems with the vaccine? And basically, it's a matter of not getting proper information. Okay, or if there is information, especially with the internet these days, you're never 100% sure how reliable or how valid that information is.
Right.
Okay. So, for starters, we have to know, are people appraising things properly? In our study, what we did was we were looking at both university students and the general public, because we don't want to restrict it to university students. But our motive here was to look at how people cope with events and find out proper strategies for government, for example, for policy. What should be done should this event occur in the future? Now, we had no idea there would be a fiasco with getting the vaccine made, mm-hmm. although we had suspicion there could be. But we certainly didn't expect that there would be problems in the distribution and these long lineups and things that we're seeing. But hopefully some of our data will give us some information. The other thing we were interested in was what would happen over time, and that is, do appraisals of events change as the situation unfolds? Now, as you know, we have a very fluid situation. One day people are saying, oh, I'm not going to get vaccinated. I don't really think it's a big risk. And a few days later, they're hovering right behind one another, waiting to get the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the tipping point, as Malcolm Gladwell would have said? What takes it from one level to another level? And so we started collecting data October 5th, I think, and we've got about, by October 23rd, we had 1,700 people, basically grouped over, I think it was two weekly periods. And looking at the changes that are occurring, we have another cohort going through now. And I haven't looked at the data on that at all, but it's about 500 people. And what we're essentially looking at now is asking the question, and this comes back to what you were asking me,
mm-hmm.
What's my personal risk? What's the risk relative to other people and so forth? But remember that the risk in H1N1 is also age-related. So university students are probably in the group, or are certainly in the group, that's most at risk. So we ask university students, how well do you know the statistics? Who's most at risk? And you find that among university students, about 45% know that that their group is in a high-risk group.
Right.
The community seems a little bit less informed. They think it's only about 30% of people in the, say, 14 to 25-year-old bracket who are at particular risk. They all seem to think, or both the students and the older people, seem to think that if you're over 61, you're at particular risk. Okay. So even though we hear, for example, that if you're over 65 or so, you're probably less at risk of contracting the disease simply because you may have been exposed to something similar previously, they seem to not realize, the participants here, that older people in this case are not at greater risk. But what I found very interesting is we ask students, what do you think the probabilities are of a student in your university What do you think the probabilities are of students in your university developing H1N1, and what percentage of them will develop it?
Right.
What they'll say is, probably about 30% will develop. That's about the average. About 30% will develop H1N1. And what do you think the chances of you developing are? And then the answer you get is about, 5%.
That's interesting.
Okay. So this is not uncommon.
There's
a sense of invulnerability to the group as a whole, but they themselves are really invulnerable. Okay, but then when you change the question slightly, what's the probability of your best friend getting H1N1? Oh, he's also about 5%. Okay, and what happens if he gets it? Oh, I still won't get it. Okay, so even though you and your friend are both equally likely to develop H1N1, if he gets it, it has no bearing on whether you get it or not. So the probabilities are always the self is more protected. Okay. But now look at what's happened in the last few weeks, and this will be interesting now to look at the data that's coming out in this next cohort. We've had a case of two kids with no known factors that could have caused death dying, and we've had a whole bunch of people suddenly showing up for vaccinations, and there's long lineups. And suddenly this has made all the news. Now, there's several possibilities here, of course. One is that, somebody just messed up. It wasn't so much that people were saying, I'm not going to get the vaccination. It may just be that the right questions weren't asked, something of this nature. Mm-hmm. So does it really mean that there's greater concern now than there was before, or was it just poor planning? I suspect, like most things, it's probably a bit of each.
Right.
But we have a mentality, it's like when there's scarce resources, everybody wants it.
Mm-hmm.
And, whether it's Cabbage Patch dolls or an H1N1 vaccine.
You're right.
When there's not enough to go around, I want mine now, or at least I want my kids. And this, I think, the big issue. It's, I can do without the vaccine. I'm not, I'll manage. But I sure want to make darn sure that my kids are protected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is part of the panic that we're seeing, or the anxiety, it's probably a better word than panic. I want to just make sure that my little kid is well taken care of. And the government so far has done a few things that's been helpful, like giving out the bracelets and shrinks the lines. But once the anxiety is there, it's hard to remove until the vaccine comes out. The media, sorry to say, this doesn't help either.
No, you're absolutely right.
It's like this morning I was looking at the CBC site, and they had in bold letters, GlaxoSmithKline gives away vaccine to other countries. Now, when you read the article, there's two versions of it, actually. One is they're giving away the adjuvant because they had more than they needed, and the second was that they're giving away the antigen.
Right.
In either case, it's not the vaccine that's being given away, but the headline led you to believe that.
Right.
Okay. So, again, there's that, the sensationalism, which simply isn't necessary.
So, with regards to the students, and the interesting observation was again the 5%, the 30%, where everybody else can get it, but it's not me that's going to get it.
Yeah.
You mentioned though that there's a tipping point or a trigger, and so with this group, are you looking for the issue or event that would circumvent or bypass that initial response that you have seen to try to determine what is it that tips them to say, I'm now in that 30%. It's not 5% anymore.
Yeah. We're hoping to find this. So, for example, is there a leader? Is there somebody that they all follow? Is there, for example, you might have a particularly important person on campus, not necessarily a sports celebrity, nothing of that nature necessarily, but it could be, who will have the ear of other people. It could be a professor, it could be a counselor, or more likely a group of people who will say, you know what, it's uncool to not get vaccinated because you could spread it to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there could be that attitude, or it could be, you know, we're all at risk. But what is the tipping point? It could, as I say, it could be a person. It could be just something in the media. We don't really know, and mm-hmm. This is something we'd like to find out. Okay. But students are students, and, you know, this age group in general,
right.
It's not a matter of students. This age group does seem to have this feeling of invulnerability. And one of the problems you get with this is, well, one question is, okay, we see these long lineups. What kind of effect will it have on people? I suspect that those who weren't inclined to go in the first place are probably less likely to go now,
mm-hmm.
and those who were inclined to go will be more likely.
Right.
So if you've already got a rationalization, oh, I don't want to go, it's not really necessary. 6 hours, brother, I'm not going.
How long is this study going to be ongoing? Is there a specific endpoint to it, or are you following this through the entire pandemic season?
Of the first 1,700 participants, we're following up a subgroup of them every 2 weeks from now through to December,
mm-hmm.
Well, actually middle of December. And we have a second cohort, or actually really a third cohort, that will come on, we hope, in mid-January. To tap into the third wave of the pandemic. So by then, we expect that a fair number of people, let's assume that the peak happens at the end of October,
mm-hmm.
At the end of November or early December. A lot of people will have seen what happens when you get it. They'll know,
right.
You know, how scary is it really, and then look at the response in the during the course of the third wave. So we hope to go to about March, or maybe April, and see what happens at that point. It's also being combined with other studies that are ongoing. So, by example, we do work in general dealing with threats of one sort or another, and we're crossing this with another study dealing with women who had breast cancer and
mm-hmm.
had been treated, and now asking them the question, how are you responding to these events? Given that they have previously been in some very high risk situation, do they see the world differently now,
right.
One way or another?
Well, I'd love to be able to follow this up with you in March when more data comes in. I'm very curious to see what happens to this group and how they respond.
Yeah, me too.
Dr. Jaime Annisman is Canada Research Chair in Neuroscience and Professor in the Institute of Neurosciences at Carleton University and Professor at the Institute of Mental Health Research at the Royal Ottawa Hospital. And Dr. Annisman, I'd like to thank you very much for fascinating observation on human behavior. Ties in a lot with a book that I've read. It's called, by Dan Gardner, a journalist, The Ottawa Citizen. He wrote Risk, the Science and Politics of Fear, where there's a lot of elements of what you've talked about in the responses of people when they are confronted with certain risky situations. So
right.
I'd like to see this real-life example play out and certainly have you back on to talk about this.
Be my pleasure.